bought of it. Some people never find it, or don't find it again. Then we are asleep in the dark.
Hello? Where are we?
She says. I roll onto my back, taking her with me, so she's on top. She opens my lips with her tiny hands.
Oh, hugger, Steve,
I say.
What's your name again?
She laughs. Nathaniel.
Ooh, posh. Love you, Nathaniel.
We can barely dress ourselves. We hold hands as if we might lose each other as we go slowly through the darkness to the front door. The moth was often away, but his absence, like his presence, rarely mattered. My sister and I were by now foraging for ourselves, becoming self-sufficient, Rachel disappearing into the evenings. She said nothing about where she went, just as I was silent about my life on Agnes Street. For both of us, school now felt like an irrelevancy. In my conversations with other boys, who should have been the friends I'd have normally attached myself to, I never admitted to what was occurring at home. That existed in one pocket, while my school life remained in the other. In youth, we are not so much embarrassed by the reality of our situation, as fearful others might discover and judge it. One evening, Rachel and I took off to a 7 o'clock screening of a film, and sat in the front row of the Gaumont. At some point, the hero's plane plunged towards the earth, with his foot caught among the controls so he couldn't get free. Tense music filled the theater, along with the scream of the plane's engine. Caught up in the moment, I was unaware of what was happening around me.
What's wrong?
I look over to my right. Between the voice that had said, "What's wrong?" and me sat Rachel, shuddering, a moan, a cow-like noise coming out of her that I knew was going to get louder. She was shaking from side to side. I opened her shoulder bag, got out the wooden ruler to put between her teeth, but it was too late. I needed to use my fingers to pry her mouth open, and she was biting down with her thin little teeth. I slapped her, and in the midst of her gasp, jammed in the wooden ruler and pulled her down to the floor. Above us, the plane crashed into the earth. Rachel's unmoored eyes were looking at me to gain security, for the safe way out of where she was. The man was bending over her too.
Who is she?
My sister. It's a seizure. She needs food. He had his ice cream in his hand and gave it to me. I took it and pressed it onto her lips. Her head pulled back, then realizing what it was, took it in greedily. The two of us crouched in the dark on that filthy carpet of the Gaumont. I tried lifting her to get her out of there, but she had taken on dead weight. So I lay down on the floor and hugged her to me the way the data had done. She looked, in the light that fell from the screen, as if she were still witnessing something terrible. As, of course, she was, for whenever such episodes occurred, she would later describe to me calmly what she had seen. The voices on the screen filled the theater, continued the plot, and we stayed there on that floor for 10 minutes, with my coat over her to make her feel secure. There are medications now to swerve a body away from this sort of collision, but there weren't any then. None that we knew of, anyway. We slipped out through a side exit and walked beyond the dark curtain towards the lit world. I got her into a lion's corner house. She had barely any energy. I made her eat something. She drank milk. Then we walked home. She did not speak about what had happened, as if by now it was immaterial, some deadly shore she had recently passed. It would always be the next day when she needed to discuss it. Not about the embarrassment or chaos in her, but with a wish to try to define the thrill building towards what was going to happen before everything dismantled. Then she could not remember any further, the brain by then unconcerned with remembering. But I knew there had been a brief time at the Gaumonts when,
Seeing the pilot struggling to escape, she herself, half-thrilled, had moved alongside him. If I do not speak of my sister in this story so much, it is because we have separate memories. Each of us witnessed clues about the other we did not pursue. Her secret lipstick, a boy on a motorcycle once, her crawling home late, giddy with laughter, or how she'd become surprisingly fond of talking with the moth. I suppose she must have found a confessor in him, but I held on to my secrets, kept my distance. In any case, Rachel's version of our time at Ruvigny Gardens, though it might nestle with mine in certain ways, would be spoken of in a different tone, with an emphasis on different things. It turned out we would be close only during that early period when we shared a double life. But now, these years later, there is a separateness towards the other, and we fend for ourselves. On the carpet, there is food wrapped in brown butcher paper. Cheese and bread, slices of ham, a bottle of cider. All stolen from the restaurant we work in. We are in another room, another house without furniture, the walls blank. Thunder fills this unlived-in building. According to her brother's schedule, this one will take a while to sell, so we've become used to camping here at the end of a day, when his customers are unlikely to turn up. Can we open a window?
No, we'll forget it.
She is strict about her brother's rules. He even needed to check me out, looking me up and down, saying I looked a bit too young. A strange audition. Max was his name. We fuck where the dining room must have been. My fingers touch the dent of impressions where table legs once rested on the carpet. We would have been under the table. There would normally have been a meal over us. I say this as I look up, seeing nothing in the dark.
You're a strange one, aren't you? Only you'd ever think that right now.
The storm abandons itself over us, shattering the soup tureens, throwing spoons onto the floor. A back wall damaged by a bomb has still not been rebuilt, and the dry thunder enters loudly, searching out our nakedness. We lie defenseless, without furniture, without even an alibi for what we are doing there, where all we have is butcher paper for a plate and an old dog bowl for water.
I had a dream I was fucking you on the weekend, she says, and there was something in the room near us.
I'm not used to talking about sex, but Agnes, she calls herself that now, does, charmingly. It's natural to her. What is the best way to give her an orgasm? Where specifically to touch her? How soft? How hard?
Here, let me show you. Give me your hand.
My mute response, half mocked by her, her smiling at my shyness.
Boy, you have many, many more years to get used to this, to keep becoming. There's abundance here.
A pause, then.
You know, you could teach me about you.
By now we like each other as much as we desire each other. She talks about her sexual past.
I had this cocktail dress I borrowed for a date. I got drunk. It was the first time. I woke up in a room and no one was there, and no dress. I walked to the tube and got home in just a raincoat.
A pause as she waits for me to say something.
Anything like that happened to you? You can tell me in French if you want. Would that be easier?
I failed French, I lie.
Bet you didn't.
Along with the wildness of her talk, I loved her voice, the thickets and rhymes of it. A sea change after the way the boys at my school talked. But something else made Agnes different from others. The Agnes I knew during that summer was not the Agnes she would be later. Even then I knew it. Was that future woman I imagined aligned with her wishfulness for herself, just as she may have believed in something further in me? It was different with everyone else I knew at that time in my life. During that era, teenagers were locked into what we thought we already were, and therefore would always be. It was an English habit, the disease of the time. The night of that first storm of summer, both of us holding each other frantically within it, I found a gift in my trouser pockets when I eventually got home. Unfolding a section of the crumpled brown butcher paper that had been our plate, I came on a charcoal drawing of the two of us on our backs, hand in hand, and above us the great unseen storm. Black clouds, lightning bolts, a dangerous heaven. She loved to draw. Somewhere in the paths of my life I lost that drawing, though I had meant to save it. I still remember what it looked like, and now and then I have searched for a version, hoping to find an echo of that early sketch in some gallery. But I've never found such a thing. For so long I knew nothing more of her than Agnes Street, where the first house we entered together had been. During our illegal days and nights in various skeletal homes, she insisted with a defensive humor on taking that as a nom de plume for herself.
Nom de plume,
she pronounced it grandly.
You know what that means, right?
We slipped out of the house. We had to be at work early. There was a man pacing up and down by the bus stop, watching us as we approached him, who then turned to look at the house, as if curious about why we had come out of it. He boarded the bus as well and sat behind us. Was this just coincidence? Was he a wartime ghost from the building we had invaded? We felt guilt, not fear. Agnes was worried about her brother's job. But as we got up to leave, he got up too and followed us. The bus stopped. We stood at the exit. As the bus started and began moving faster, Agnes leapt off, staggered, then waved at me. I waved and turned back past the man, and later, at some point in central London, I jumped off, and he couldn't catch me. The Mussel Boat. Our first day on the Thames, Rachel and I and the Darter travelled west until we were almost free of the city. I'd need a good river map now to show you the places we passed or paused at, whose names I learned by heart during those weeks, along with the charts of tidal information, the intricate causeways, old toll houses, draw docks we entered and left, building sites and gathering places we learned to recognize from the boat, Ship Lane, Bull's Alley, Mortlake, the Harrods Depository, several power stations, along with the 20 or so named and unnamed canals that had been cut a century or two earlier, like spokes fingering north from the Thames. I used to lie in bed repeating all the declensions of the river in order to memorize and so remember them. I still do. They sounded like the names of kings of England, and they became more thrilling to me than football teams or mathematics tables. Sometimes we travelled east beyond Woolwich and Barking, and even in the darkness knew our location by just the sound of the river or the pull of the tide. Beyond Barking there was Caspian Wharf, Erith Reach, the Tilbury Cut, Lower Hope Reach, Blythe Sands, the Isle of Grain, the Estuary, and then the sea. There were further hidden locations along the Thames where we paused to meet seagoing vessels that unloaded their surprising cargo, then walked the several animals that had hesitatingly disembarked, all of them attached to one long rope. In this way they defecated and relieved themselves after their 4 or 5 hour journey from Calais, before we coaxed them onto our mussel boat for another brief journey, to be collected later by people we saw only briefly, whose names we never knew. Our involvement with these river activities had begun the afternoon the Darter overheard us talking about the approaching weekend. Casually, speaking as if Rachel and I were not in the room, he asked the Moth if we might happen to be free to help him out with something or other.
Day work or night work?
Probably both.
And is it safe?
This was said sotto voce by the Moth, as if we should not be hearing it.
absolutely safe,
the data answered loudly, looking towards the two of us, offering a false smile and suggesting complete security with an offhand wave. The question of legality never surfaced. The moth murmured,
You can swim, can't you?
And we nodded. The data threw in,
They like dogs, don't they?
And this time it was the moth who nodded, having no idea whether we did.
It's resplendent.
The data claimed that first weekend, one hand on the wheel, the other attempting to remove a sandwich from his pocket. He did not appear fully focused on the steering of the barge. A cold wind scalloped the water, gusting and shuddering against us from all sides. I supposed we were safe with him. I knew nothing about boats, but I immediately loved the landless smells, the oil on the water, brine, fumes sputtering out of the stern, and I came to love the thousand and one sounds of the river around us that let us be silent as if in a suddenly thoughtful universe within this rushing world. It was resplendent. We almost grazed the arch of a bridge, the data leaning his body away at the last minute as if that would make the boat follow him. Then a near collision with a quartet of rowers who were left buffeting in our wash. We heard their yells and witnessed the data's wave towards them as if it were fate, not anyone's fault. That afternoon we would pick up 20 greyhounds from a silent barge near the church ferry stairs and deliver them in silence to another location downriver. We had not been aware of the existence of such movable cargo, did not know of the strict laws countering the illegal importing of animals into Britain, but the data appeared to know everything. Our theories about the data's style of walking in a crouch completely changed when he took us onto that muscle boat. Rachel and I moved cautiously down the slippery ramp, while the data barely watched what he was doing, half turning to make sure Rachel did not miss her footing, while simultaneously tossing his cigarette into the 4-inch gap between the embankment and the lilting boat. Steps that felt hazardous to us were an easy dance floor for him, and that wary crouch was now replaced by casualness as he moved along the foot-wide gunwales covered in rain and grease. He later claimed he had been conceived during a 24-hour storm on the river. His ancestors were generations of lightermen, and thus he had a river body that showed an accent only on land. He knew every tideway between Twickenham and Lower Hope Point, and could identify docks by their smell or the sound of loading cargo. His father had been a freeman of the river, he boasted. This in spite of the fact that he also spoke of him as a cruel man who'd forced him into the boxing profession in his teens. The data also had a mouthful of whistles, for every barge, he told us, had its own signal. You learned it when starting work on a new boat. It was the only signal you were allowed to use over the water as a recognition or a warning, and each whistle was based on a bird call. He'd met river people, he said, who walking in a landlocked forest had suddenly heard their own barge whistle, though there was no river in sight. It turned out to be a kestrel protecting its nest, a breed of bird that must have once lived by a river 100 years before, whose sound had been borrowed and learned by generations of bargemen. After that weekend, I wanted to keep helping the data with the dogs, but Rachel began spending more time with the moth. I suspected she wanted to be more of an adult. But I'd be waiting for the data in my waterproof coat when he swung by in his car. He had barely concerned himself with me the first times we met at Ruvigny Gardens, when I was just some boy in a house he happened to be visiting. But I now discovered the data was an easy man to learn from. He cared less about you than the moth did, but told you precisely what he needed you to do, as well as what about him was to be kept from others.
Breast your cards, Nathaniel, he'd say. Always breast your cards.
What he needed, it turned out, was someone like me, a semi-reliable person to help him gather greyhounds 2 or 3 times a week from one of those silent European vessels. And so he persuaded me to leave my job at the restaurant, and instead help him transport them in darkness on the muscle boat to various locations, where a van would then spirit his living cargo further away. We managed about 20 of those shy travellers on each boat ride. They sat shivering on deck during our journeys, which sometimes lasted as late as midnight, and were spooked easily by a loud noise or the searchlight of a launch suddenly alongside us. The data worried about what he called preventative men, and it meant I had to nuzzle my way into their midst under the blankets and calm them in the fetid dog air as the river police slid by. "They're after more serious things," the data announced, justifying his low-level criminality. It became clear that what we were delivering had in fact no guarantee of financial success. There was no assurance about these animals as racing dogs, no knowledge whether they were fast or slow. All that was valuable about them was that they provided the unknown element, and, as the public was uncertain about their worth, it guaranteed reckless betting, bets made by strangers relying on looks as opposed to authentic bloodlines that could recommend them or reveal them as worthless. A reckless bet meant active money. You put pound notes on a dog with no past because of a seemingly knowing glance from the leashed creature, or the line of its thigh, or the overheard whisperings of others you hoped might know, but in truth did not. The dogs we had were wastrels with no recorded past, either kidnapped from a chateau or saved from a meat factory to be given a second chance. They were as anonymous as roosters. On the moonless night river, I calmed them by simply raising my teenage head in a gesture of strictness whenever they attempted to bark. I felt I was quieting an orchestra, and it had the charm and pleasure of first power. The data stood at the wheelhouse guiding us through the night, humming, "But not for me." It always sounded like a sigh the way he sang it to himself, his mind elsewhere, barely conscious of the lyrics in his mouth. Besides, I knew the sadness of that song in no way reflected his intricately dovetailed relationships with women. I knew this from having to provide alibis for him, or deliver false messages from a public phone box that would excuse his absence some evenings. Women could never be certain of his exact hours of work, let alone what the work actually was. Those days and nights, as I began to enter the shadowy timetable of the data's life, I found myself within a confabulist pattern that drew together barge smugglers, veterinarians, forgers, and dog tracks in the home counties. Bribed veterinarians provided distemper shots to these aliens. Sometimes we needed temporary boarding kennels. Forgers typed up canine birth certificates to provide evidence of owners in Gloucestershire and Dorset, where the dogs had supposedly been whelped. Dogs that had never heard a word of English till now. That first magical summer of my life, we smuggled more than 45 dogs a week at the height of the racing season, collecting the gun-shy creatures from a dock near Limehouse onto the muscle boat, and riding the river in darkness into the heart of London towards Lower Thames Street. Then we travelled back downriver the way we had come, and those late-night river returns, the boat now empty of dogs, were the only moments the data was free of his complicated schedules, and there would be no interruptions. I was curious now about the data's universe, and during those nights he talked openly about himself and the complexities of dog racing, and he occasionally questioned me. "You met Walter when you were very young, isn't that so?" he asked me once. And when I looked at him, startled, he withdrew the sentence like a 2 forward hand on a thigh. "Ah, I see," he said. When I asked him how he had met Olive Lawrence, I prefaced it by admitting to him that I liked her. "Oh, I noted that," he said. This was a surprise, for the data had always appeared unaware of and unconcerned with my responses. So, how did you meet her? He pointed to the cloudless sky. I needed advice, and she is this specialist, a geographer, an ethnographer. He dragged the word out as she had done. Who knew there were people like that, who still read weather by the kind of moon it might be, or by the form of a cloud? Anyway, she was useful for something I was involved with, and I like women smarter than me. Mind you, she is. Well, she surprises you. Those ankles. I didn't think she'd walk out with me. She's Mayfair, you know what I mean? She likes the lipstick, the silk. She's a barrister's daughter, but I don't think the dad's going to help me out if I'm in trouble. Anyway, she was going on about lenticular clouds and anvil clouds and outer reader blue sky. Though it was the ankles I was leaning towards. She's got that greyhound line I appreciate. But you can never win. Not with her. You can get hold of only a corner of her life. I mean, where is she now? Not a word from her. But still, that night with the goat, you know, I think she liked it. She wouldn't admit it, of course, but it was like signing a peace treaty during our dinner. Quite a dame. But not for me. I loved it when the data spoke this way, as if I were an equal who might understand those unstable subtleties in women. Besides, hearing another version of the goat incident was a further layering in the world that I was entering. I felt I was a caterpillar, changing colour, precariously balanced, moving from one species of leaf to another. We continued through the dark, quiet waters of the river, feeling we owned it, as far as the estuary. We passed industrial buildings, their lights muted, faint as stars, as if we were in a time capsule of the war years, when blackouts and curfews had been in effect, when there was just war light, and only blind barges were allowed to move along this stretch of river. I watched the welterweight boxer, whom I once had perceived as harsh and antagonistic, turn and look towards me, talking gently as he searched for the precise words about the ankles of Olive Lawrence, and about her knowledge of cyan charts and wind systems. I realized he had probably stored away that information for some aspect of his work, even as it also diverted him from that slow blue pulse at her neck. He grabbed my arm, placed it on the wheel, and walked over to the edge to relieve himself into the Thames. He exhaled a groan. He always had some soundtrack alongside his actions, and I suspect it was there during amorous moments, when the pulse at Olive Lawrence's neck beat beneath a thin film of sweat. I recalled the first time I witnessed the data urinating at the Dulwich Picture Gallery during a reconnaissance, whistling, the fingers of his right hand holding a cigarette as well as his penis, which was aimed towards the edge of the urinal. "Pointing Percy at the porcelain," as he called it. Now, as I steered the barge, I could hear that dutiful soliloquy. "I've found more clouds of grey than any Russian play could guarantee." He murmured it within the privacy of himself, womanless at this late hour. The barge slowed. We moored up tight against the fenders of the dock and climbed out. It was 1 in the morning. We walked to his Morris and sat there for a moment, paused, as if we were attaching ourselves now to another element. Then his foot pressed the clutch, the key turned, and the noise of the car broke the silence. He always drove quickly, almost dangerously, through the cross-hatching of narrow, unlit streets. These were parts of the city that since the war were only partially lived in. We passed streets of rubble, now and then a bonfire. He lit a cigarette and kept the windows open. It was never a straight route home. He weaved left, right, certain when to slow, suddenly turning into an unseen lane as if testing a getaway route. Or did he need this risk-taking to keep him awake at this hour? Is it safe? I mouthed the moth's question silently into the air outside my window. Once or twice, if he thought I was not tired, the darter climbed out with false weariness and took my place in the passenger seat to let me drive. He'd give a sidelong glance as I dealt with the clutch and cluttered over Cobbins Brook Bridge. Then we drifted into the inner suburbs. Our conversations ended by now. I was often exhausted by these far-flung duties I was given. Bone and blood tests needed to be fictionalized. False seals from the Greater London Greyhound Association had to be forged so our immigrants could enter any of the 150 dog tracks in the country, as if they all were preparing to gather at the Count of Monte Cristo's ball with false identities. A vast mongrelization of pedigree dogs was taking place, and the greyhound industry would never recover from it. Before she departed, Olive Lawrence, upon discovering the data scheme, had rolled her eyes and remarked,
"What next? Imported foxhounds? An imported child stolen from the Bordeaux region?"
"Of course it would be Bordeaux,"
the data retaliated. Still, it was our nights on the mussel boat I loved. The boat, originally a sailing cotter, had now been equipped with a modern diesel. The data was borrowing it from a respected Dockland merchant, who needed it only 3 days a week. Unless, he warned us, a royal wedding was suddenly announced, which would mean the hurried importation of cheap crockery with a royal image, fired up and shipped from some satanic mill in Le Havre. In that event, the transportation of dogs would have to be postponed. It was a long grey boat, built in Holland, he said, which used to coast low over mussel fields. It was distinct from other barges, and a rare object on the Thames. The ballast tank in the hold could open and fill with salt water, so that the gathered mussels could be stored and kept fresh until arriving at port. But the main virtue of the cotter for us was its shallow draft, which allowed us to travel the length of the Thames, from the estuary to as far west as Richmond, even Teddington, where the river was too shallow for most tugs and barges. The data could also use it for other dealings, when he travelled into the channels and canals that led north and east out of the Thames, towards Newton's Pool and Waltham Abbey. I still hold on to those names. Erith Reach, Caspian Wharf, as well as the streets I drove with the data, long past midnight into the city. We would have just completed one of our turbulent barge journeys, and he would be trying to keep me awake by telling me plots of some of his favourite films. His voice took on an aristocratic pitch as he reenacted lines of dialogue from Trouble in Paradise.
"Do you remember the man who walked into the Bank of Constantinople and walked out with the Bank of Constantinople? I am that man."
The car barreled along the unlit roads, and he would turn towards me to regale me about Olive Lawrence's habits during an argument, or rattle off the names of the key streets we were driving through. Crooked Mile, Sewardstone Street, or a cemetery we were passing, saying,
"Learn these by heart, Nathaniel, in case I have to send you off one night on your own."
We moved at speed so high we often reached the city in less than half an hour. Now and then there'd be lyrics the data would sing out loud about
"The bride with the guy on the side," or "The dame who was known as the flame."
He did this jauntily, suddenly gesturing with his arm, as if he had to interrupt himself to remember one more example of deceitful passion that had just occurred to him. Greyhound racing was already a jubilantly illegal profession. Millions of pounds changed hands. Huge crowds came to White City Stadium or the bridge at Fulham, or visited the temporary tracks that had sprung up all over the country. The data had not leapt quickly into the business. First of all, he investigated the territory. The sport had a pariah-like status, and he knew there would eventually be government controls. Stern editorials in the Daily Herald were warning the public that there existed in greyhound racing a moral decline that derived from passive leisure. But the data did not feel the public's leisure was passive. He'd been at Haringey when, after a 3-1 favourite was disqualified, the crowd burned the starting traps to the ground, he being one of many who was knocked flat by a water hose manned by the police. He guessed there would soon be dog licences, recorded bloodlines, stopwatches, even rules for the official speed of the mechanical hare. The possibilities of chance would grow small. Betting would be based on reason. He needed to locate or invent a quick, slender entrance into the business, something up to now hidden from view, and squeeze himself into that margin between what had been thought about and what had not yet been considered. And what the data saw at the dog tracks was unjudgeable talent among indistinguishable creatures. By the time we ran into him at Ruvigny Gardens, he was importing a dubious population of unregistered foreign dogs. He had already spent a few years in the shifting tents of Spivory. He had finessed the art of doping, not so much to give dogs strength and endurance, but to cause a hypnotic slowness in them, by feeding them Luminal, a tranquilizer used for epileptic seizures. The procedure involved careful timing. If they were given it too close to the beginning of a race, the animals would tumble into sleep in their starting gates and have to be carried away by one of the bowler-hatted stewards. But with a 2-hour interval between consumption and the race, they would run convincingly, then become dizzy when cornering the bends. Luminal-flavored liver was administered to a particular group of dogs, for instance brindle dogs or male dogs, so you could avoid betting on them. Other concoctions invented on someone's home chemistry set were tried. Dogs fed liquids gathered from human genitalia, infected with a social disease, suddenly became distracted by itching, or were overpowered by unwanted erections, and slowed down during the last 100 yards. The data then started using chlorotone tablets, bought in bulk from a dentist and dissolved in hot water. Once again, a hypnotic trance ensued. North American park rangers, he said, had been using it to anesthetize trout during their tagging process. Where and when in his past had the data learned about such chemical and medicinal information? I knew he was a curious man and could extract information from anyone, even an innocent chemist sitting next to him on a bus, much the way he had picked up details about weather systems from Olive Lawrence. Yet he did not reveal himself easily. A trait perhaps left over from his days as the boxer from Pimlico, when he was light on his feet while verbally solemn, enigmatic but curious about another's body language, a counterpuncher, a close observer, and then a mocker of another man's style. It was much later that I would make the connection between his familiarity with such drugs and his awareness of my sister's epilepsy. By the time I began working with him, the golden years of doping were almost over. 34 million people were attending greyhound races a year. But now the racing clubs were setting up saliva and urine tests, so the data needed to find another solution, where betting on dogs would once again not rely only on logic and talent. What followed was the data's use of imposters or ringers in order to bring confusion and chance back to the tracks. And I became fully caught up in his plans, accompanying him as often as I could on his barge, the flood tides carrying us into or out of London, on those night journeys I sometimes still yearn for. It had been a torrid summer. We were not always confined to the mussel boat. Sometimes we picked up 4 or 5 dogs from a well-hidden Anderson shelter in Ealing Park Gardens and drove out of London with them in the back seat, peering out from the Morris, expressionless as royalty. At a small town gymkhana, We raced them against the local dogs, watched them dart like cabbage whites across the marked fields, then drove back to London with more money in the darter's pocket. The dogs sprawled exhausted behind us. They were always eager to run, often in any direction. Whether our imported ringers would be natural racers or collapse from distemper, we never knew. But no one else did either, which was its financial charm. All we knew of the dogs lounging behind us as we drove towards Somerset or Cheshire was that they were fresh off the boat. The darter never bet on them. They were simply there like useless cards in a deck to camouflage a favourite. Amateur tracks were sprouting up everywhere, and we followed every rumour of them. I'd be struggling with a large, unfolding local map, searching for a village or a refugee camp that had an unofficial third-rate track. In some of them, dogs chased a bunch of pigeon feathers tied to a branch dragged by a car in an open field. One track we visited used a mechanical rat. I remember on those drives how the darter, whenever he stopped at a traffic light, would lean back to stroke the scared animals gently. I do not believe it was because he loved dogs, but he knew they had stepped on English soil only a day or so earlier. Perhaps he thought it would calm them, make them feel they owed him something when they raced for him on those distant tracks a few hours later. They would be with him only a short time, and by the end of the day, there would be fewer dogs returning to London. Some would simply not have stopped racing, and would have disappeared into the woods, never to be seen again. One or two he'd sell to a vicar in Yeovil, or maybe to someone at the Polish refugee camp in Doddington Park. There was never sentimentality in the darter about heritage or ownership. He scorned bloodlines among dogs as well as humans. "It's never your family that's the problem," he announced, as if quoting some surprisingly overlooked line from the Book of Job. "It's your damn relatives. Ignore them. Find out who can be a valuable father. It's important to disturb rare bloodlines with changelings." The darter had never kept in touch with his own family. After all, they had practically sold him into the Pimlico boxing rings at 16. One evening, he entered 13 Ruvigny Gardens, carrying a heavy book he had removed with difficulty from a local post office, where it had been chained to the counter. It was a ledger published by the Greyhound Association, eager to warn the public of track spivvery, listing all persons suspected of criminal offences. Besides mugshots, some of them blurry and some of them vain, there was a list of incidents that ranged from forgery to the printing of tote tickets, as well as doping, race-fixing, pickpocketing, and even warning of those who coursed through crowds with an intent to seduce. The darter asked Rachel and me to leaf through the 300-page list of criminals and find him there. But of course we could not.
"They have absolutely no idea who I am," he exclaimed proudly.
He was by now sophisticated in his methods of tunneling under the rules of dog racing, and he once confessed to us, somewhat shyly, about his first upsetting of the rules. He had thrown a live cat onto the track during a race. The dog he had put his money on, it was his first and last bet, had accidentally bounced off a fence at the first bend. Now a cat had been flung in front of the other dogs, who became so distracted that the only object still continuing the race was the mechanical hare, aided by a 2-horsepower motor that ran at 1,500 revs per minute. The race was declared void. The cat disappeared, as did the darter after getting his original stake back. None of the darter's lady friends ever wished to accompany him on these out-of-town journeys. But never having had a dog in my life, I chose to sit in the back with their heat-seeking muzzles reaching over to rest on my shoulder. They were quick, mischievous company for a boy who was a solitary. We re-entered the city around dusk, The dogs asleep against one another. Not even the blaze of city lights woke them. Not even a crust from one of the darter's sandwiches, tossed back over his shoulder a half hour earlier. It turned out the darter had a dinner engagement he wished to keep, and he persuaded me to take his Morris and return the dogs to the Anderson shelter in Ealing Park Gardens. He would be forever in my debt. I dropped him off at a tube station to meet a new paramour, the scent of greyhounds still on his clothes. I had no license, but I had a car. I kept the dogs with me and drove out of the depths of the city towards Mill Hill. I was to meet Agnes in another of those empty houses, and I rolled the windows down as I arrived to give the dogs air. I walked towards the house, turned and saw them watching me tragically, spectres of disappointment. Agnes opened the door. "One minute," I said. I ran back and ushered the dogs into the small front garden so they could relieve themselves. I was herding them back into the Morris when she suggested we all come in. Without a pause, they rushed past me and leapt into the darkness of the house. We left the keys at the foot of the front door and followed the excited barking. Once again, there was no possibility of turning lights on in the three-story building. This was the largest house either of us had been in, and it was undamaged. A brother was moving up in the post-war property world. We heated two cans of soup on the blue circle of gas, then settled in on the second floor so we could watch each other and talk in the spill of a streetlight. We were more at ease now. There was less tension as to what would, could, and should not happen between us. We drank the soup. The dogs rushed into the room and out again. We had not seen each other for a while, and if we hoped our night would be passionate, it would be, but not in the way we expected. I didn't know enough about Agnes's past, but as I said, no dog had ever entered the rooms of my childhood, and now in the large semi-dark rooms of this borrowed house, we wrestled them to the ground, their long mouths warm against our bare hearts. We raced from one room to another, avoiding street-lit windows, signaling each other with whistles. One dog was caught simultaneously in both her and my arms. She turned her face up to the ceiling and howled through it to the moon, the dogs like pale anteaters in the half-light. We followed them into distant rooms. We met them coming down the strict, narrow darkness of the stairs.
"Where are you?"
"Behind you."
Car lights filled a window, and I saw Agnes, naked to the waist, with a hound hanging off her hip, as she lifted it down to a lower landing. The one we had discovered was nervous of stairs. A sacred moment in my life I carry secure within whatever few memories I hold from that time, filed and labeled in that half-completed way. Agnes, with dog. Unlike other memories, it has a location and a date. It was during the last days of that torrid summer. And there is a wish in me to know if that long-ago teenage friend of mine still remembers and thinks of that series of borrowed houses in East London and North London and the three-story house in Mill Hill, where we crashed our bodies into dogs that were in chaotic delight after being restrained for hours in the back seat of a car, now scattering their racing claws like high heels up and down the carpetless stairs. It was as if Agnes and I had given up every desire except to run alongside their high-pitched barking and pointless virility. We were reduced to being servants, butlers, providing fresh bowls of water that they slurped without grace, or throwing remnants of our stolen sandwiches into the air, so they were leaping high as our heads. They ignored thunder when it came, but when it began to rain, they paused and veered towards the large windows, and with tilted heads, listened to its suggestive clicks.
"Let's stay the night," she said.
and when they curled up to sleep, we slept on the floor beside them, as if all around us these animals were our longed-for life, our wished-for company, a wild, unnecessary, essential, unforgotten human moment in London during those years. When I woke, the dog's thin sleeping face was beside me, breathing calmly into mine, busy with its dreams. It heard the change in my waking breath and opened its eyes, then shifted position and placed its paw on my forehead gently, either as a gesture of careful compassion or superiority. It felt like wisdom. "Where are you from?" I asked it. "What country? Will you tell me?" I turned and saw Agnes standing, already dressed, her hands in her pockets, watching and listening to me. Agnes of World's End, of Agnes Street, of Mill Hill, and Limeburner's Yard, where she had lost that cocktail dress. I knew even then I needed to keep this part of my life away from the darter and the moth. Theirs was the world I was living in after my parents disappeared. And the world of Agnes was where I now escaped to, alone. It was now autumn. The racetracks and gymkhanas were closing down. But I was still so much a participant, the essential go-between in the darter's world, that he would find it easy to persuade me to skip school when term started. It began with missing just 2 days a week, but I would soon be claiming a host of illnesses, from mumps, which I had just read about, to whatever disease was going around. And with my new contacts, I could provide forged letters about my health. Rachel knew about some of this, especially when it had progressed to 3 days a week. But the darter cautioned me not to tell the moth, giving one of those complex waves of his hand that I knew how to interpret by then. In any case, this was more intriguing work than the time I was supposed to be spending preparing for my school certificate exams. The darter's muscle boat began drifting with a new purpose. These days he was transporting European china for the respected Dockland merchant. Boxed cargo was more manageable than greyhounds, but he claimed to have a bad back, and so needed help. "Too much sex standing up in a dark mews or cul-de-sac." He tossed the line out like a spectacular morsel. So he persuaded Rachel back onto our boat on the weekends for an extra shilling or two, and we now found ourselves travelling up narrow canals that ran north from the Thames, which we had been unaware of till then. Our starting points and destinations always varied. It might be the rear entrance of the custom house at Canning Town, or we might find ourselves floating along the shallow streams by Rotherhithe Mill. There was no longer a need to silence 20 dogs, and it was daylight work and autumn silence. The days grew colder. Being so much in the darter's company, I was now at ease with him. Sunday mornings, as the barge travelled under the trees, he sat on a crate and searched through newspapers for any upper-class scandals, reading choice ones out loud.
"Nathaniel, the Earl of Wiltshire has accidentally asphyxiated himself by tying a rope round his neck, then tying the other end to a large lawn roller while half-naked."
He refused to explain why a person in the nobility might do this. In any case, the lawn's gentle slope meant the roller had serenely continued downhill, pulling the Earl's undressed body along with it and strangling him. The lawn roller, the News of the World concluded, had been in the Earl's family for 3 generations. My more serious sister ignored such stories and concentrated on learning her lines in Julius Caesar, for she was to play Mark Antony in the school play that term. By this point, I was simply expecting to fail my school certificate exams and ignored rereading Swallows and Amazons, that crap book as the data had called it. Now and then he would lean his head back and attempt a conversation with me, showing concern as to how I was doing at school. Fine, I would say.
And your mathematics? Do you know what an isosceles triangle is?
Yes, of course.
Splendid.
Not that we are touched by such things as concern, even if false, when we are young. But now, in retrospect, I am touched. We steered our way up a narrowing cut. It was a different atmosphere now, with sunlight falling through yellowing leaves, the smell of wet earth rising from the riverbanks. We had loaded the barge with boxes at Limehouse Reach, where the data said they made quicklime centuries earlier. Immigrants disembarked there from the East India ships and walked into the new country without a common language. I told the data I had heard a Sherlock Holmes mystery on the radio called The Man with the Twisted Lip that took place where we'd loaded the china that morning. But he shook his head doubtfully, as if literature had nothing to do with the world he belonged in. The only books I'd seen him read were westerns and bodice rippers, specifically one that merged the two genres called Kicking Whore's Pass. One afternoon, we needed to urge the barge between the narrowing banks of the Rumford Canal. My sister and I stationed on opposite sides of the deck, yelling directions to the data at the wheel. The last 100 yards of the cut were almost fully overgrown. At its end, there was a lorry waiting, and two men approached the boat and unloaded the boxes wordlessly, the data barely acknowledging them. Then we reversed the barge like a cornered dog for a quarter of a mile, until the channel became wider. Romford Canal was just one of our destinations. Another journey took us along Gunpowder Mills Canal. At one time, only shallow draft powder boats and ballast barges had travelled along it, transporting munitions. The innocent-looking canal had been used for this purpose for almost 200 years, because at the end of it was Waltham Abbey, a gentle edifice lived in by monks as far back as the 12th century. During the recent war, thousands had worked on the grounds of the abbey, and its explosives were transported along those same cuts and tributaries down to the Thames. It was always less dangerous to transport munitions on quiet waterways than on public roads. Sometimes the roped barges were pulled along by horses, sometimes by teams of men on either side of the canal. But now the munitions factories had been dismantled, and the unused canals were silting up, becoming narrower between their overgrown banks. And on weekends, this was where Rachel and I, the sidekicks of the data, now floated in the silence of those waterways, listening to a new generation of birdsong. What we carried was probably not dangerous, but we were never sure. And after our constantly changing routes and destinations, Rachel and I no longer fully believed the data's stories about the delivery of European china to pay back the merchant who had let him borrow his barge during dog racing seasons. In any case, until the weather turned harsh, we travelled those barely used waterways, guiding the boat along the narrowing rivers. The data with his shirt off, his white ribbed chest bare to the October sun, and my sister memorizing her exits and entrances for Julius Caesar, until the brown stones of Waltham Abbey rose into view. We sidled towards the bank, and once again heard whistles, and once again men appeared and loaded our boxes onto a nearby lorry. Again no words were passed between us. The data stood there, half-dressed, and watched them with not even an acknowledgement or nod of his head. His hand was on my shoulder, which committed me to him, or him to me, and it made me feel safe. The men departed, the lorry bouncing away under the overhanging branches up a dirt road. The sight of two teenagers in a boat, one bent over her schoolwork, one with a rakish school cap on his head, must have seemed innocent enough. What kind of family were we a part of now? In retrospect, Rachel and I were not too different in our anonymity from the dogs with their fictional papers.